I used to work in Mississippi at Starbucks. Worked there for many years. It was a good company to work for. And there came a time that this particular store was going to have an event where the partners, that's what they called us who worked for them. We weren't employees, we were partners. They said, well, the partners were going to have an opportunity to share something important about their lives with the customers. As we were preparing for this event, when the manager came to tell me about the event, she pulled me aside. She said, that's what we were doing. And she says, now, I know that religion is kind of your thing, but as a company, we want to not have anything said about religion or politics because both of those can be divisive, and we just don't want to be divisive in this time where we're sharing things with other people. And it's true, religion and politics are thought of as divisive things. In our store, it was very divisive. Politics especially, there's one individual who in a conversation with someone over politics made the remark that he had a bullet for Barack Obama. And a week later, we had Homeland Security coming to interview us because of this individual and his stance on politics. So it can be a very divisive issue. Even amongst believers, those of us who have the same foundation, we can come on very different sides when it comes to our politics, when it comes to our government policies. You would think that if we start from the same place, we would end up at the same location, but it's not the case that we're always consistent within ourselves. Sometimes we compartmentalize. Well, today within our text, we have this religious text that speaks of the origin of government, so it should be probably the most controversial message I've spoken about. It has promised to be divisive, and we will see if that is the case. We've been studying the story of the Bible for a number of weeks now, God, as he's working through history. And he's telling he's not just revealing things about himself in propositional statements. He's telling a story, and you're following that story. And the reason a story is important to find out about someone, to find out about their characters, because you can learn things as you watch them in a story and how they react in a certain situation that you can never know through simple propositional truth. I could tell you facts about my wife, that she is pretty, that she is nice, that she loves art, but you could probably think of a host of people that fit those same qualifications. But if I were to tell you a story about my wife, if I were to tell you how she sacrificed so that I could come and go to seminary and tell you about her struggles in taking lesser positions and not knowing anybody in the area that we're at, you would know a little bit about her character. You would learn about her. And that's what we have going through this story. We're learning about the protagonist, God. We're learning about him through his character, through his long suffering, and we're watching him as he's interacting with his disobedient people. We're also learning about the antagonist, Satan, and his character, and his character's desires. So I hope that not only are you beginning to understand the text better and the different, and being able to recognize whose character is being reflected by the minor characters as we go through the story, but I hope you're beginning to discover that this is also a philosophy that plays true in your life. And I hope you're finding that you are able to distinguish better when the seed of the serpent's philosophy appears. Because sometimes it can find its place veiled in places we're very comfortable with, very familiar with. For the example, if I were to read this to you, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, that to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed, that whenever any form of government becomes destructive of these ends, it is the right of the people to alter or to abolish it, and to institute new government, laying its foundation on such principles and organizing its powers in such form as to themselves shall seem most likely to affect their safety and their happiness. This is the opening of the Declaration of Independence. And my question would be, does this espouse the philosophy of God, of the seed of the woman, or does it espouse the philosophy of the seed of the serpent? Where does the government derive its authority? Does the government derive its authority from the sovereign populace? Is the authority of the government created and sustained by the consent of its people? Something to think about as we go through our story. We've made it to chapter 9, and we are introduced now to something new, a national rule. God initially creates man. He creates him as his representative over creation, and this is an individual rule of man over beasts, which man fails. But upon Adam's failure, he is cast out, he is exiled from the garden, and God, of course, promises that a new one will come. There will be one after who will rule in his place, who will redeem. Now, in the course of time, we're looking for this one, this seed of the woman, and Noah arises, and he announces that there is a coming judgment. There is a delay for that judgment, and after that delay, God's anointed one gets in the boat, God's judgment rains down, and only those with Noah are delivered into a new world. This is a microcosm of what's going to happen in chapter 10 through Revelation chapter 22. This is the whole Bible in a small picture. Because what you're going to see, if you look at the back of your page, you have a chart comparing these two. You have the first microcosm with the individual rule, but then you're going to see that with the creation of the national rule, God's going to create a nation, a special nation, Israel, and it's going to rule over the Gentile nations. And you're going to see that ultimately Israel will fail. It will be exiled from their land, much like Adam was exiled from the garden. They're going to be exiled into the Gentiles' land, put in subjection under the Gentile nations. And God is going to promise a national king that will come and deliver them. So Jesus, God's ultimate anointed one, appears on the scene. He declares that there's going to be a judgment. Then there is a delay, and ultimately we expect Jesus to come to execute that judgment, and only those who are related to him, who are righteous through faith in him, will be spared. The nation and the believing Gentiles will be ushered into a new earth. It is the same story playing through again. Now, we are going to see that just as Genesis 1 through 9 was a foreshadowing of 10 through 22, what was implemented, that individual rule, is still going to carry through with the national rule. We started with an individual rule, but we're going to find that it's going to move through the story parallel to the national rule. The individual rule, the seed of the woman, is ultimately going to come from this nation that the Lord establishes, Israel. The seed of the woman will come out of the nation of Israel, will rule as the king of Israel, will sit in that 315 spot, and ultimately at the end of the story, they will rule over the nations. The 315 one will. That's where this story is going. So when we come to our text today, the flood has just ended. The conditions of the flood in the beginning of chapter 9, as we ended chapter 8, they're reminding us of the initial creation. The waters were covering the earth. The earth is completely submerged in water. God commands, it recedes. And now Noah and his sons, and their wives, are the only ones that enter into this new earth, this new world. God's going to give them commands, similar to when we have the beginning of creation, the first creation. God's going to tell them, be fruitful, multiply, fill the earth. Just like Genesis chapter 1:28, minus the subdue part. The Lord's going to bless the man and the woman and say to them, be fruitful, multiply, fill the earth, and subdue it. Rule over the fish of the sea and the birds of the sky and over every living thing that moves. He tells Noah and his family, be fruitful, multiply, fill the earth. However, your relationship is now different with the animals. You see, the animals are terrified of them now. Things have changed. Not only that, the Lord delivers the animals over to man now as a food source. They are now, for the first time, able to eat something other than plants and animals. Now, if you remember, Abel was a keeper of flocks. They did not eat the flocks. Those were used as coverings. Those were used as sacrifice. But they were not used as a food source. For the first time, the Lord delivers over the animals as a food source. Now, there is a question as to what point in Genesis history does the animal kingdom come to the point, as Alfred Lord Tennyson would say, nature is red in tooth and claw. You look around and it's vicious in the animal kingdom. They are vicious. They tear one another apart. They eat one another. We don't know if that would have been the case before the flood or not, but no doubt at this point, nature is at that point. So man can eat the animals, but the animals are certainly eating one another. We come to verse 5, and the Lord implements something completely new. He says, whoever sheds man's blood, by man his blood shall be shed. For in the image of God he made man. Whoever sheds man's blood. Remember, we are dealing with an earth now that only has believers. The judgment that came through Noah wiped out all of the wicked. If you weren't related in trusting in faith to what Noah was preaching as that preacher of righteousness, you did not get on that boat. Noah preached for at least 120 years. The only people that responded were his three sons, their wives, and his wife. Everyone else, gone. So everyone here at least responded positively in faith to Noah's warning that judgment was coming. So the question arises, and it's a good question. Kenny actually brought it up last week. Where do the unbelievers come from? We're far enough in the story to know that it hasn't been eradicated, right? But right now, all we have are believers. Well, Noah did act as the second Adam, or a Adam at least down the line. He did implement judgment. He did enter into a new earth. He is given the same commands as the original creation. So we have this second creation place, if you want to call it that. It is a completely new landscape and it is a new earth. However, it is clear that Noah is not the ultimate 315 one. And the author is going to make sure you know that before we get out of chapter 9, because Noah is going to end up just like the first Adam ended up, naked and ashamed. But the question remains, where do these unbelievers come from? Well, although the wicked world was eradicated, this Adam did not crush the head of the serpent. Satan is still alive and well on planet Earth. So, us as the intelligent reader, we've been following this story along. We recognize that there is animosity between the seed of the serpent and the seed of the woman. There doesn't seem to be any seed of the serpent currently on the scene. The Lord is about to implement a new system of government. We're looking to see, wait a minute now, where is the antagonist going to pop up in this story? Where is this conflict going to arise again? So we're just watching and we're reading and we're waiting for it, expecting there to be some kind of conflict in the near future. Now, if you look at Genesis 5 and Genesis 9, verse 5 and 6, this is the creation of human government. Verse 5 and 6. From every man, from every man's brother, I will acquire the life of man. Whoever sheds man's blood, by man his blood shall be shed, for in the image of God he made man. The Lord is entering into something, a new arrangement with man. Up until this point, God executes judgment on man. God brings the flood down on the wicked world with its violence and lawlessness run rampant. But something's going to change. Now man is going to execute judgment on man. There's a change in the economy that's going on the earth. And this government that the Lord is put in place with a purpose. It has a function. That function will be to restrain and punish lawlessness so that the righteous can live in peace without fear. We're not trying to get back to Genesis 4 and Genesis 6 again, where the violence, everyone is violent in the earth. Everyone is seeking after their own name. We're implementing some form of restraint on the earth. It's not just an aside, oh, by the way, this is where government comes from. It's a part of the story and it's necessary to the story because that government is going to be where the 315 one comes to rule. Also, the government is going to be a foreshadowing for us. Just like Genesis chapter 2, verse 17, when the Lord gives the prohibition from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, you shall not eat, for in the day that you eat from it, you will surely die. And we said, I think they're going to eat from that tree. We get to this point. Everyone on the earth is believers. The Lord is implementing this government system. He says, whoever sheds man's blood, by man his blood shall be shed. For the image of God he made man. You say, it's going to happen. He's not just saying this for no reason in the story. We recognize that somewhere along the line, that seed of the serpent is going to creep back into the story. And that's why this government, this implement of restraint, is being interjected by, at this point, by God. Now, in the future, the judgment is still going to be in the hands of man from this point forward. Jesus, the God-man, ultimately will be the one who judges. He will be the one who all judgment is given to. He will rule the nations with a rod of iron. But at this point, we're just looking. We're following along the story. We're still following. We're saying, I don't know which line to follow. There are three sons right now. We were doing pretty good up until the point of Noah. But now we're here and I'm saying, I don't know which line the seed of the woman's coming from. But I do see what you're doing. You're implementing some government here. And I'm expecting the serpent to stick his head back up, because this is a foreshadowing that there's going to be a problem. Now, God also gives Noah a little comfort. He makes his covenant with Noah. He says, look, never again am I going to destroy the earth in this way, in the way that I've done. You can imagine Noah and his family probably had a very healthy fear of the Lord and his judgment. We don't know if there was. Some speculate that there was not rain prior to the flood. Maybe, maybe not. But regardless of the case, you can bet the first thunderstorm, they were probably hightailing it back to the ark. So the Lord is going to give a sign. He's going to say, look, I'm never going to judge you this way again. And I'm going to give you a sign, something to comfort you, something to remind me that I'm not going to judge you in this way. And it is a bow. It is the rainbow, the thing that has been hijacked by our culture right now to promote homosexuality. But that is God's sign. He's no longer going to judge men that way. He will judge through his 3:15 man. When we come down to verse 18, the sons of Noah who came out of the ark were Shem, Ham, and Japheth. These three sons. We don't know whether Shem or Japheth was the oldest. Interestingly enough, the text is kind of fuzzy about it. Your text in chapter 10 may make a statement. If you look at verse 21, my text, the NASB, will say, to Shem, the father of all the children of Eber, that's the Hebrews, and the older brother of Japheth, children were born. But your text might say, or the brother of Japheth, the elder. So there's question as to who was the oldest in the family. Was it Shem? Was it Japheth? It was one of the two. It was not Ham. But we see the conflict arise. Noah is still integral to the story. Okay? Whenever we come and we're looking at any character in the story, the question that comes up in our mind is, why is blank here? What is Noah still doing on the scene, right? He's already done this. He's judged a flood. He has sons. And the pattern we've been following is so-and-so begot so-and-so begot so-and-so. He died, begot so-and-so. He died. Noah's still on the scene. Something more important has to go with him. When we see, he comes out of the ark and he begins farming. He plants a vineyard. He plants fruit in the ground. He drinks wine. He drinks of the fruit. He becomes drunk. He uncovers himself inside his tent. He finds himself, much like Adam, naked. Much like Adam, ashamed. And this is where we get our first glimpse of the seed of the serpent peeking his head back into the story. Now, we don't know up until this point who to be watching. Is it Ham? Is it Shem? Is it Japheth? Where is this 3:15 seed coming? The author's going to tell us. Just wait. Verse 22. Ham, the father of Canaan, saw the nakedness of his father and told his two brothers outside. But Shem and Japheth, they took a garment, they laid it upon both their shoulders and walked backwards and covered the nakedness of their father. And their faces were turned away so that they did not see their father's nakedness. When Noah awoke from his wine, he knew what his youngest son had done to him. And as a result, there is this curse laid down. Notice it is cursed on Ham's son. Ham's line is going to be cursed. Ham was on the boat. Ham believed what Noah was saying. But there's a problem here. Although Ham did believe Noah's righteous warning, although he did get on the boat, he's making a very serious error. You see, Noah is not just Ham's father. Noah is God's anointed one. He is the one that God has been dealing with the world through at this point. And treating the anointed one lightly is a very serious crime. You're going to see it all the way through it. You'll see it most explicitly explained in Deuteronomy chapter 17. I will just read it for you. Deuteronomy chapter 17, verses 11 through 13. This talking about the priests and the judges. According to the terms of which the law which they teach you, and according to the verdict which they tell you, you shall do, and you shall not turn aside from the word which they declare to you, to the right or to the left. The man who acts presumptuously by not listening to the priest who stands there to serve the Lord your God, nor the judge, that man shall die. Thus you shall purge the evil from Israel. Then all the people will hear and be afraid and will not act presumptuously again. You will see this again and again played out through Scripture, namely through the kings, priests, prophets, and judges. You'll see it through Abraham. Abraham will do a sinful thing. He will lie and give his 224 wife to a Pharaoh. He'll give his 224 wife to a king, Abimelech. He will lie and say, she's my sister and not my wife, she's just my sister. And the Lord will come to those rulers in their dreams and let those rulers know, I'm about to blot you out because the woman you've taken is a married woman. Abimelech argues with him. He says, Lord, you know I did this in the innocence of my hands. And the Lord says, I know you did that, but you better give her back to Abraham and he'll pray for you. He will intercede. He's sitting in that 315 spot. He's a placeholder. He is the one that the Lord is dealing with. You see it with Abraham. You see it with David. You're going to see it all throughout the story. You do David and Saul. Saul comes into David's cave. There are how many caves around in Israel? A gazillion. It's divine providence. He walks into David's cave. David says, don't lay a hand on him. He's God's anointed. No one puts a hand on God's anointed but God. So when we come to stories like Bathsheba, we cannot use that as an example because we're not God's anointed. This is a story about a very special individual in God's divine program sitting in that 315 placeholder spot. Which is why, if you remember, how did David get judged when he slept with Bathsheba? Nathan had to come to him and trick him into judging himself because no one can lay a hand on God's anointed but God. So Nathan tells him a story about a sheep and says, what ought to happen? He says, man ought to die. The penalty for the sheep is fourfold. Nathan says, you are the man. So now the punishment goes on David. He judged himself. And four of his children die as a result of it. But this is where we see the beginning. Noah is the anointed one. Ham makes light of his father, who is not just his father, he is God's anointed. But also he makes light of the covering. This nakedness is not just, it's not to say something bad that being naked is sinful. The story has nothing to do with that. It's a literary allusion. It is pointing us back to Genesis. It's saying, remember what you just read? Because these books were not normally broken up. You know, we read a chapter this week and a week later we'll read another chapter. They're read at one time. So in one reading session, the guy's sitting there reading and they remember, oh yeah, we just talked about Adam and Eve. They were naked. They were uncovered. God provided them a covering. Cain, no, he didn't care much for that covering, did he? He offered vegetation. He had his own provision. Ham doesn't think much of the covering. He makes light of his father. While his sons, Shem and Japheth, they take it seriously. So this is where we're going to see the serpent peeking his head back into the story. So we don't know at this point. We're saying, okay, I see where the serpent is working, but watch through what Noah says. Cursed be Canaan, a servant of servants. He shall be to his brothers. And he also said, Blessed be the Lord, the God of Shem, and let Canaan be his servant. May God enlarge Japheth and let him dwell in the tents of Shem, and let Canaan be his servant. So now Shem is put up top. Now we know who to follow. The line is going through Shem. And as we go through this story, it's just going to keep getting more and more and more precise. We are watching for that 315 one, and we just got told it's going to come through Shem. Not Japheth, not Ham. So our story continues. We get to chapter 10, and we know that we're going to be dealing with nations at this point. We know that we're going to be dealing with nations, and the people in Egypt would have known that. You know, all these people obviously descended from Noah, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. So we're saying, who did they descend from? How do we categorize each nation? And that's what chapter 10 is going to tell us. Verse 2 of chapter 10, the sons of Japheth were Gomer and Magog and Madai and Javan and Tubal and Meshech and Tyrus. Verse 5, from these the coastlands of the nations were separated into their lands, everyone according to his language, according to their families, to their nations. Skip down to verse 20. These are the sons of Ham, according to their families, according to their language, by their lands, by their nations. Verse 31, these are the sons of Shem, according to their families, according to their languages, by their lands, according to their nations. And ultimately, 32, these are the families of the sons of Noah, according to their genealogies, by their nations. And out of these, the nations were separated on the earth after the flood. We are moving to a larger scale. We are dealing with nations at this point. And the audience is going to watch. We're watching for how Satan is going to thwart God's plan. Through Ham, we're going to see all the ites come. In chapter 10, verse 15, Canaan, of course, became the father of Sidon, and his firstborn was Heth, and the Jebusite, and the Amorite, and the Girgashite, and the Hivite, and the Arkite. All those people that we're going into that land to displace, yeah, they all came from Canaan, the one that God cursed through Noah. All those people, the cursed ones. But also, we're going to see another similar literary style that we're already familiar with. We know what Satan's philosophy looks like, right? At this point, we're kind of familiar. When you see an individual coming out, we're looking for self-righteousness, we're looking for self-elevation, we're looking for an individual that is looking for fame, who's operating by his sight, not by God's sight, not by God's revelation, right? We're kind of familiar with that. We're looking through this genealogy, chapter 10, and the author pauses to describe one of Ham's descendants. Verse 8. Now, Cush became the father of Nimrod. He became a mighty one on the earth. He was a mighty hunter before the Lord. Therefore, it is said, like Nimrod, a mighty hunter before the Lord. The beginning of his kingdom was Babel and Erech and Akkad and on and on and on. I mean, we've seen this before. This is Genesis 4 and Genesis 6 all over again. We say, okay, been there, done that. Okay, I got it. Seed of the serpent. He's working in the nations again, right through Ham, through this individual Nimrod. I've seen this before. I follow. And we're going to look and see what Nimrod does. Under Nimrod's leadership, the people begin to create a city nation. A cluster of cities surrounded around a capital. It is a city nation made in an attempt to be the place, the location, the land from which the world is ruled on behalf of God or the gods. This system that they determine, that they make up, their gods. We have it described in more detail in chapter 11. Now the whole earth used the same language and the same words, and it came about as they journeyed east that they found a plain in the land of Shinar, and they dwelt or settled there. And they said, come, let us make bricks and burn them thoroughly. They used brick for stone, tar for mortar, and said, let us build for ourselves a city and a tower whose top will reach into heaven. Let us make for ourselves a name. Otherwise, we'll be scattered abroad over the whole face of the earth. Otherwise, we'll have to do what the Lord commanded us to do. No, let's make a name for ourselves. Let's go to God on our own standard. Let's determine how man will relate to God and what God is like. So, this tower This tower that they're gathered together is going to be the means by which they reach out to God, apart from the 315 seed. Just like Cain. I don't need the 315 seed. I'm not 315 seed, whatever. Here, let me appease you with some vegetation. It's the same philosophy of the serpent that you see again and again. Nothing is new. It's old hat. We don't need 315. We'll decide how we reach God. So the object is to have the world come to Babylon. This ultimately is the city of Babylon. Babylon. And they're going to be the intermediary. They are going to be the one who intercedes with the Lord. They are the one who offers terms via a tower. Now, the Lord, interestingly, makes an observation. They're making a name for themselves. They're building a tower. They're working up their fame and their might. But by the time we get to verse 5, it says, "The Lord came down to see the city and the tower which the Son of Man have built." Verse 7, "Come, let us go down to see." He basically is saying, the tower didn't quite make it, did it? The text gives the impression that the Lord is walking along and said, what are they working on down there? Is that a tower? Let's go down and see what's going on down there. The Lord goes down to their failed attempt to reach up to Him as intermediaries, and He is going to sovereignly act. But notice His action. He is not going to judge them like He just did on the Genesis 6 world. His judgment is going to parallel a previous judgment, though. He's going to confuse their language so that they will not understand one another's speech and scatter them abroad from over the face of the whole earth so that they stop building the city. Then the city is named Babel, Gate of God, but it also is a play on terms Belel, confusion of speech. But he scatters them across the earth, much like Cain. God doesn't execute judgment on Cain. He exiles him. He sends him out. God doesn't execute judgment on Babel here. He exiles him. But it's coming. At this point, we're waiting. There's a delay. We say, okay, this city has been built. This happens. But this city is going to keep coming back. Not only is this story going to be a tale of two seeds, the story is a tale of two kingdoms, but it's going to be a tale of two cities. And God's city has not been introduced yet. In a couple chapters, it will. But right now, we're looking at the devil's kingdom. In chapter 18, 17 and 18, really. But chapter 18 in the book of Revelation is going to let us know what happens to that city. It's still coming. In fact, Saddam Hussein, before he died, was working on resurrecting the city of Babylon. Babylon is still an inhabited city today. But in chapter 18 of Revelation, John saw this. "After these things, I saw another angel coming down from heaven, having great authority, and the earth was illumined with his glory. And he cried out with a mighty voice, saying, 'Fallen, fallen is Babylon the Great. She has become a dwelling place of demons and a prison of every unclean spirit, and a prison of every unclean and hateful bird. For all the nations have drunk of the wine of the passion of her immorality. And the kings of the earth have committed acts of immorality with her. And the merchants of the earth have become rich by the wealth of her sensuality. I heard another voice from heaven saying, Come out of her, my people, so that you will not participate in her sins and receive her plagues. For her sins have piled up as high as heaven, and God has remembered her iniquities.'" He is patiently waiting. But because of his patience, that doesn't illustrate that judgment is not coming. He's just long-suffering. God has remembered her iniquities. "Pay her back even as she has paid, and give back to her double according to her deeds. And the cup which she has mixed, mix twice as much for her. To the degree that she glorified herself and lived sensuously, to the same degree give her torment and mourning. For she says in her heart, 'I sit as a queen, and I am not a widow. I will never see mourning.' For this reason, in one day her plagues will come, pestilence and mourning and famine, and she will be burned up with fire, for the Lord God who judges her is strong. And the kings of the earth who committed acts of immorality and lived sensuously with her will weep and lament over her when they see the smoke of her burning. standing at a distance because of the fear of her torment, saying, "Woe, woe, the great city of Babylon, the strong city, for in 1 hour judgment has come." So we understand the story at this point. We are changing gears. We have seen the entire story in microcosm. We've seen it illustrated, but now we're going to the big scale, the same scale that we're working with today, and we're starting to play for keeps. And we're looking for that seed as it's coming through Shem. So I understand that God's repopulated this new earth. He's established nations. He set up a rule for government, and I'm following this line of Shem, still looking for the 315 one. And I know now where the story is headed. God's going to form a nation of Israel. It's to rule over the other nations. And I know that the 315 one will come from Israel, ultimately rule over Israel. He will be the king of glory that sits in that 315 spot forever. And he will rule all the nations. Ultimately, that time is coming. But now for us, in our day, as we understand that these government systems are in place, we know that they came from the Lord, that their authority comes from the Lord. It is not just man and his own reasoning. I ask, what is our responsibility to those governing authorities as believers in the church age? Do we have the right to rebel against this governing authority? What if this governing authority is being led by an unbeliever that is a tyrant? Do we have a right to rebel then, or to institute a form of government that is led by someone of the faith? What's the appropriate behavior of the believer in respect to our earthly governing body? Do we ever have right to rebellion or revolution in this? I'd like to look at that at just a moment before we end today. Something to think about in the meantime. If you'll turn with me to Romans chapter 13 briefly. Romans chapter 13. This is Paul speaking in verse 1. Every person, and this is in the time of Nero. Nero is the current one that is ruling over Rome. Every person is to be in subjection over the governing authorities. For there is no authority except from God, and those which exist are established by God. Therefore, whoever resists authority has opposed the ordinance of God, and they who have opposed will receive condemnation upon themselves. For rulers are not a cause of fear for good behavior, but for evil. Do you want to have no fear of authority? Do what is good, and you will have praise from the same. For it is a minister of God to you for good. But if you do what is evil, be afraid, for it does not bear the sword for nothing. For it is a minister of God, an avenger who brings wrath on the one who practices evil. Therefore, it is necessary to be in subjection, not only because of wrath, but also for conscience sake. For because of this, you also pay taxes. For rulers are servants of God, devoting themselves to this very thing. So I ask, for your own personal wrestling with God, as he has implemented this portion of his theocratic kingdom, he has established a governing body. How does this reconcile with some of these statements for you? Benjamin Franklin. In free governments, the rulers are the servants and the people their superiors and sovereigns. Paul. Every person is to be in subjection to the governing authorities, for there is no authority except from God, and those which exist are established by God. Woodrow Wilson, liberty has never come from the government. Liberty has always come from the subjects of the government. The history of liberty is a history of resistance. Paul, therefore, whoever resists authority has opposed the ordinance of God, and they who have opposed will receive condemnation upon themselves. John Basil Barnhill, when the people fear the government, there is tyranny. When the government fears the people, there is liberty. Paul, for rulers are not a cause of fear for good behavior, but for evil. Do you want to have no fear of authority? Do what is good, and you will have praise from the same. It goes on and on. I know not what course others may take, but as for me, give me liberty or give me death. I determine what's right. You're not the boss of me. Thomas Jefferson, the tree of liberty must be refreshed from time to time with the blood of patriot and tyrants. What is liberty, you ask? Thomas Jefferson says, rightful liberty is unobstructed action according to our will within the limits drawn around us by the equal rights of others. I do not add within the limits of the law, because law is often but the tyrant's will, and always so when it violates the rights of the individual. Liberty is you get to call it for yourself and not have to listen to what somebody else says to you. I think that Peter Marshall got it right. He says, may we think of freedom not as the right to do as we please, but as the opportunity to do what is right. We are very fortunate to live in this nation. The Lord is the establisher of all the kings of the earth. We have the privilege of being able to meet like this and study God's word, and we should be thankful and give praise to that. But we should also consider who is the one who installs our governors before we go implementing our serpent-like desires. I ask, are we looking in the daily lives and seeing these things pop up? It is the seed of the serpent.